Comrades, we're discussing this afternoon the Arab Revolution and the rise of Arab nationalism in the post-war period as part of the development of the colonial revolution over after the Second World War. And the movement, the distorted form these revolutions took because of specific historic conditions. Although these specific historic conditions do not exist anymore in the same way, the traditions, the ideas, the authority of Arab nationalism is part of the Arab Revolution even today. Well, throughout the region, the point where the revolutionary process in modern terms starts is the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. And specifically in relation to Egypt and Iraq, I will make some reference to Iraq as well. An important turning point in the development of, or at least in the breakup of the previous property relations in society and establishment of capitalist relations in the countryside and the rest of the economy, was the opening of the Suez Canal. And of course, the establishment of direct colonial rule over the area. Just to give an idea of how explosive the transition or the decay of the previous relations in society, how explosive situation has created over a few decades. I'll give you just a few figures on class composition of society in Iraq. Under the impact of the integration on the world market, which transformed the whole economy of Iraq to a platform for exports and for production and export of food, especially cereals. Between 1860 and 1930, the nomad population goes from 37% to 7% nomad. While at the same time the peasant population increases in proportion from 41% to 68%. After the opening of the Suez Canal, the export of cereals produced in Iraq went from a value of 140,000 Egyptian pounds, 140,000 pounds, to 8 million. In a few decades. This is the scale of the increase. And this produced a huge impact on the very fabric of society in all the Middle East. We're talking about Egypt with a reference to Iraq, but this is true for almost every country. Under the British or French colonial rule, there is a process of polarization of land property, which was largely common property or state-owned for. The case of Iraq at the eve of the revolution of 1958, we have a situation where two-thirds of all cultivated lands were in the hands of 2% of the landowners. And 49 families were controlling 17% of the best land. At the same time, in the countryside, most of the peasants are landless peasants. More than two-thirds, even three-quarters in some statistics of all peasants in the countryside are don't own even an acre of land. The huge fields cultivated for export require a workforce, but in most cases, the overwhelming majority of the landless peasants have no possibility whatsoever of having earning a living out of their work. So there is a huge process of emigration from the countryside towards the cities, where although they won't find better living conditions, there are more opportunities for temporary jobs as serfs or in small industries. This gives to the whole area an extremely unstable class composition, the point of view of the imperialist rulers. And basically, from the 1920s, everywhere there is one wave after another of revolution, of revolts, of revolutionary events taking place, harshly repressed by the imperialist occupation armies. Just to give an example, but the big revolt in 1920 in Iraq, which was machine gunned by the British officials, killing more than between 5,000 and 10,000. But the picture, going back to Egypt, of the specific conditions that were facing Egypt on the eve of the 1952 revolution, coup d'etat of three officers. Egypt formally got an independent status and a brand new monarchy set up by the British colonialists. Interestingly, well, comrades will know how the partition of the Middle East was arranged between French and British imperialism. Thanks to the biggest WikiLeaks of history, which was the decision of the Soviet government in Russia to publish all the secret deals of Tsarim. We know about the secret deal of between Sykes and Picot, the diplomats between France and Great Britain. In 1916, they decide how the partition of the Middle East should be. This is ratified after the war. The winning powers decide this partition in 1920 in the conference of San Remo. The British set up in Egypt a monarchy, a completely artificial state. And in Egypt is already heavily transformed by the colonialist penetration and the integration in the world market. Mainly agriculture and its cotton case production. The picture of Egyptian society is similar to the one I described for Iraq. Where the breakup of the previous property relations and the establishment of capitalist relations in the countryside have created a mass of proletarized peasants. And the ruling class, upon which the British occupation regime and the monarchy rests, tries to find its base, the ruling class is fundamentally alienated from the mass of society. For example, most of the big landowners are not even speaking Arabic. They are of Turkish origins. A big part of those who are the closest supporters of the monarchy are foreigners, in fact, in the eyes of millions of Egyptians. The urban bourgeoisie, very small in numbers, is mainly made up of naturalized Greeks, Armenians, anyway, people who moved to Egypt during the Ottoman Empire. And what is there of indigenous bourgeoisie, which has developed during the integration of Egypt in the world market, is basically an agrarian-based bourgeoisie, which based itself and has enriched itself through the dealings with imperialism. So, as we can see, in a situation where the democratic revolution explodes in Egypt after the Second World War, there is not really anything that can be described as a national bourgeoisie who can lead this revolution. And even those sections of the bourgeoisie who are represented by the WAFD party, WAFD, I don't know how to pronounce the best pronunciation, who come from the revolution of 1919 and have a tradition of nationalism, Arab nationalism, Egyptian nationalism. Even that section of the bourgeoisie is extremely hostile to any prospect of agrarian reform, which is one of the main demands of democratic revolution. The vast majority of the masses, petty bourgeoisie, urban petty bourgeoisie, agrarian petty bourgeoisie, the landless peasants, the working class, which make up 95% of the population. By 1945, is wary of British occupation. During the war, in petty bourgeoisie, intellectual petty bourgeoisie, there is a wave of sympathy towards Germany because of the struggle against Britain. And the British rulers, who have no real basis in society, of course, before realizing that they cannot hold that position and they need to withdraw somehow, meet as usual, because that's the normal way to deal with uprisings and struggles and demonstrations that they to apply to keep power. But under these new situations of a mass uprising of the majority of Egyptian society, the repression just provokes more further explosion of the revolution. One of the features of this uprising is extreme hostility towards the rich and wealthy, and these proletarized masses with absolutely nothing, unemployed in the cities and in the countryside, are extremely unstable from the point of view from the political point of view, and erupt in sudden outbursts of rage. In the post-war period, to add to this situation, there is a specific acute economic crisis with the economy, which is dependent on cotton exports, and prices fall suddenly between the late 40s and 1950s. They're nearly halved. So while the production of cotton is increasing year by year enormously, the total revenue is falling. There is an explosion of inflation, and of course, all these factors put together constitute an even bigger pressure on the impoverished masses in the cities and the countryside. Another important factor in the development of the revolutionary crisis in the whole Middle East and in Egypt in particular was the demise of the direct rule of Britain, in this case, in case of or French colonialism, in case of other countries. Because although, formally speaking, Britain, at least, we can discuss about France, come out as victorious out of the war, as victorious. In reality, their domination, the status of Britain as a dominant power is over at the end of the war, and has been overtaken by the United States. But in a situation where Britain still holds, formally speaking, holds its grip over an empire which is covering the whole world. The uprise of the masses throughout Asia, the Middle East, are hitting hard this empire, and Britain has to quit direct colonial control of a big part of its former empire. So this is a very powerful factor in increasing the explosion of the national struggle in the ex-colonial colonies. And the third important factor is, as the outcome of the Second World War has created a new power on world relations, which is it's the fact that the Soviet Union emerges enormously strengthened and with a bigger authority out of the Second World War because of the role they played in it of Germany, Nazis. So at the same time, we have a relative weakening of imperialist rule over the whole colonial world, and the emergence of a powerful alternative to colonial rule is represented by catalyzing the hopes of millions, hundreds of millions of workers and youth throughout the colonial world, and this is the USSR. So, paradoxically, the biggest counter-revolutionary apparatus, apart from the imperialist powers, the Stalinist Soviet Union, the Communist Union, emerges from the Second World War with a huge political authority over the masses throughout the world. And this, of course, represents a huge distorting element in the process, which I'll deal with. Going back to the revolutionary upsurge of 1945 to 1947, it's quite interesting, because this This part of the movement expressed probably the highest level of organization and consciousness on part of the working class, the vanguard sections of Egyptians. There is an upsurge in strikes and even factory occupations. And incredibly, for the conditions of Egypt, this mass movement converts movement of the working class, industrial working class, and the youth students, mainly coming from petty bourgeois backgrounds. They converge and unite under the pressure of repression and the attacks from the British troops. In February 1946, a demonstration of students in Cairo marches through a bridge, which is a bridge that opens, and the police decides to open the bridge while the demonstration is passing, killing several students and more than 100 injured. This massacre is just one more massacre in the history of the demonstrations and strikes and so on, but has a huge impact. As a result of that, the students make an appeal to the workers to set up a national coordinating committee of all the committees that are already formed in schools, universities, in factories. In these committees, you can find members of the Communist Party, left WAFTists, nationalists, trade unionists, workers, ordinary workers. And they coordinate, they create a national national committee of workers and students in Cairo, which is, of course, a huge step forward in the organization of the movement. It calls for a general strike and a demonstration in Cairo on the 21st of February. This movement has no clear leadership, part of the committee, but I'm talking about the parties. The huge demo during the general strike is harshly repressed. Again, machine guns, several killed. But this committee goes on operating until at least July, when the final blows come to state repression under the leading cadres of this movement are arrested. I'll have to make a small detour to describe what the situation was with the main organizations. As I said, the WAFT is the main bourgeois nationalist organization. It comes directly from the revolution team. They are basically one of the democratic faces of the system of the monarchy. It's a bourgeois party. They represent a part of the bourgeoisie which is mildly opposed to British occupation, and they are in favor of reforming the monarchy, giving some more democratic rights, but no talk whatsoever of agrarian reform. This is a big issue. Agrarian, no, they are opposed, front opposed to the. Then there is an important factor in the situation, in the negative, which is the Communist Party. Now, the communist parties in the Arab world are formed quite late in general, quite late in time comparing to other parts of the world, and they emerge as an organized force in the 30s, more or less, depending from country to country, and already are Stalinized parts once they actually structure themselves. They are under the influence of the Stalinist bureaucracy. So in a number of countries, this provokes an early abortion of the communist organizations, depending on the timing, on the moment when the Communist Party formed. But of course, they also have a powerful, they can represent in certain moments a powerful point of attraction for millions of worker peasants. And sometimes they even reach a mass base, like in the case of Iraq, or nearly a mass base. But the problem is that the early stages of the communist movement in the Arab countries, and in the case of Egypt, it's particularly true, are marked by two major crises in the years we are talking about. As a consequence of the Stalinist policies, for example, the war period, the Second World War period, there is a sudden turn in the policies of the Third International and Stalin. which has provokes deadly results for the movement in all the colonies. And this turn is provoked, as always, empirically. The bureaucracy, the Soviet bureaucracy, reacts to events and imposes turns in the political orientation of all the parties according to their interest. As comrade know, in 1939 there was the deal with between the Soviet Union and Germany, Nazi Germany, of a pact of non-aggression, the Molotov-Ribbentrop deal. In the early years of the war, the position of all communist parties was to attack the imperialist aggressors, which is Britain, France. And the communist parties everywhere in the Arab world become, they grow, they become strong on the grounds of opposing the occupation of the colonial powers. But then this deal is broken by Hitler, and there is the invasion of the USSR by the Nazi army. And in 1941, suddenly, the line changes overnight. The imperialist powers are not so bad, after all, they are democratic. And they oppose in the war, they oppose Nazism, which is the big monster we everybody should fight against. And this line applied in the colonial world means that the Communist Party become collaborators with colonial occupation. So overnight, the anti-imperialist struggle is suspended by the Communist Party, and they start organizing the war effort, putting people to support France or Britain, depending on what country, breaking up strikes, suppressing even actively demonstrations, and so on. Now, this change, of course, creates all sorts of problems to the Communist parties. The Communist parties disintegrate. Countless splits and demoralization. So the Communist Party, which is the only tradition, there is no social democratic tradition whatsoever in the colonial world, most of the colonial world, the only tradition of the working class, basically is has been sacrificed by the Stalinist bureaucracy of the USSR for their own needs. But nevertheless, after the war, the Communist parties gain support again. And although they don't play a leading role in the Egyptian revolution, but they still have some roots. And in Iraq, they grow from strength to strength, playing more of a leading role. I'll learn that later on. The Communist Party grows in this revolutionary wave between 45 and 47. But here it comes, the second big blow to the communist movement in the Arab world specifically, which is the role played by the Soviet Union in the early days of the State of Israel. The big revolutionary wave in Egypt is cut across by the events in Palestine. Between 1947 and the first part of 1948, Britain gives up their mandate over ruling over Palestine. There is an increasing civil war, unilateral civil war, pushed by the Zionist leaders of the Jewish Agency, a campaign of terrorist attacks against Arab neighborhood, Palestinian neighborhoods, in order to drive them out and consolidate the Jewish authority, and to create the conditions for the proclamation of the State of Israel. The United Nations passed a resolution in favor of the partition of Palestine. This partition of Palestine is rejected by the Palestinians and is used by the Zionists to increase their campaign of terror and impose it fait accompli. I think comrades are familiar with these events, but I just mentioned them. And eventually, through this campaign of military campaign, to drive the Palestinians out of the territory of the Zionists want to conquer as Israel, with several hundreds or even a few thousands of people killed in the process, and at least 300,000, maybe more, refugees, Palestinian refugees, abandoning their homes and leaving their villages. Eventually, Israel is proclaimed as an independent state in the 14th of May of 1948. Well, we can easily imagine what the impact of these events were on the masses throughout the Arab world. There was no Al Jazeera at the time, but the news were spreading anyway. And there was a huge wave of support, mass support for military intervention in order to stop Israel. Ah, but I forgot to mention a small detail. The first government to recognize the State of Israel was the Soviet Union. I won't go into details on the reasons for that, but that's what happened. And the communist parties everywhere had to adopt a line of not supporting any attempt to intervene in this war. They were sabotaging the war against Israel. This is the real death blow of the communist movement in Egypt, which opens a huge vacuum, which eventually is filled by three officers of Nasser. The Communist Party will never recover from this crisis in Egypt, although they survive as party. A wave of desmoralization splits hit the communist movement throughout the Arab world. On the eve of the biggest revolutionary wave that this part of the world will experience in many years, in Egypt, the king exploits the situation and sends the army against Israel, together with other Arab nations. But this is just a temporary stabilization to the situation, because the complete failure of the Arab army's war against Israel provokes a new explosion just in a few months. The defeat of the Arab countries in the what is called in Israel the independence war, and what is called in the Arab world as Nakba, the catastrophe. This defeat provokes shockwaves and refuels the whole revolutionary situation. It provokes consequences, serious consequences even within the army. The collapse and the mistakes and the betrayals, the complete dilettante of the Supreme Council and leadership of the army, the high command, provokes a complete desmoralization of the army officers in a situation where the grip of the monarchy over the army is completely lost. Since 1939, because of some concessions that were given to the nationalist movement in Egypt by the members, since 1939, the doors of the military academy, which forms, educates the officers for the Egyptian army, were open to sections of the petty bourgeoisie. So by the late 40s, most of the officers were not coming from the very top ruling classes to be before. And because of the convulsions in society in those years, the army, which is not a body which is completely separate from society, is heavily affected. And a small movement, clandestine movement, which was set up by a few officers, was called the Free Officers Movement, starts to grow like wildfire, recruiting lower rank officers. And this is the moment when, after the defeat of the Egyptian army in the war against Israel, the revolutionary struggle picks up again in new forms. There is an explosion of strikes again. The reformist leaders of the trade unions are kicked out by the workers. There are peasant revolts and peasant war spreading in the countryside. Peasants occupy the land of the high aristocracy in 1951. And a wave of armed struggle starts, supported by quite a big chunk of the urban peasant population. The demand is to wage a revolutionary war against Israel, to end with the monarchy, and of course to have the agrarian reform, seize the land and guarantee better life for all the poor peasants. and to end the British rule over. By the beginning of 1952, this huge wave hits the cities again, and at the beginning of 1950, there is an upheaval in all the bigger cities by the majority of proletarianized unemployed. We have to underline that in the situation where the Communist Party collapses, the vacuum is filled on the one hand by the Free Officers Movement, and on the other hand by a reactionary organization which until then didn't have mass support amongst the workers and in the countryside as well. It was more a kind of petty bourgeois organization. The Muslim Brotherhood, who start to become a factor in the situation. The program of the Muslim Brotherhood is quite a reactionary program. But they fill the vacuum because they are organizing the resistance against the British occupation. Their position is xenophobic. It's not against the occupation as in terms of anti-colonial imperialist. And they counterpose to the capitalist development, which is, of course, seen by the mass of the population as the source of, rightly, which the Muslim Brotherhood identifies with foreign penetration and corruption of the traditional Islamic values Egypt society. They propose a return to Islam against capitalism. But they grow not because of their program, but because of what they are doing, filling the vacuum which is left open by the Communist Party on the left. Because they are organizing the resistance against British rule and the recruiting volunteers to go and fight against Israel, while the Communist Party was supporting Israel and sabotaging the same war effort. In 1952, there is a turning point. The guerrilla war, the countryside, the uprising in the cities, strikes, all this is reaching a new peak. again, with through an incident which materializes, catalyzes the anger. The British rule organized some auxiliary police force in order to support the activities of British troops. This auxiliary force is called Buluk Nizam and is composed of poor or semi-poor semi-proletarian elements from the city. The command is given to petty bourgeois elements. And this is not really a wise move on part of British imperialism because these auxiliary police force are heavily affected by the revolutionary wave. And actually, they start to protect the armed organizations which were attacking every symbol or even the troops of occupation. So after the, I don't know, thousands episode of attack against British troops, the British High Command has a very clever idea, which is to retaliate against the auxiliary police. They assault a barrack of the auxiliary police. The policemen resist, and 50 of them are killed before surrendering. So this is again an incident which, in the situation, explosive situation that was there, actually determines the end of colonial, direct colonial Britain. The reaction to this is a unification of all the movement to a huge mass demonstration, 1 million people in Cairo, which curiously was addressed by a WAFT minister. That's a funny insight. We say with the gun against his forehead, was encouraged to deliver a speech where he proposed to break relations with the UK and sign a friendship treaty with the Soviet Union and even to arm the people. The mood of the crowd was, of course, one of ending whatever oppression right now. So they didn't wait for decrees or anything. They just started storming every symbol of the colonial rule in Cairo. In an episode which is called the Cairo Burning, They torch the Rivoli, the metro, the fashion cafes, the big malls, expensive colonial symbols, the clubs of the colonialists, the Barclay Bank, and so on and so forth. The day of upsurge everywhere. But this explosion is completely an explosion of rage, but it's not organized, not led. The committee has been dissolved. There is no leadership. So after the 26th of January, there is a situation where there is a complete standstill, an impasse where the ruling class is not strong enough to impose its rule again. And the working class is still too weak and without a leadership in order to take power. There is a situation where it opens up a huge vacuum of power in society. And this vacuum of power cannot be filled by the Communist Party, which hardly exists, nor by any other force. So eventually, because of the huge pressure and the decomposition of the state, this vacuum is filled by the revolutionary coup of the free officers. This is a coup in July 1992, which gains mass support, of course, but opens up a completely new situation where the revolution now is developing in a completely distorted way. And it's important for us to take a little bit of time to see what is the theoretical explanation that our tendency developed around this kind of phenomenon. Because the development of the revolution in Egypt, of course, every revolution has some specific features and so on, resembles the process in many other countries that happened same period of time after the Second World War. And this peculiar development, as we can see, was not a necessary step or a necessary stage in development of the revolution. Because in the case of Egypt, what we have so far until the beginning of 92 is basically development of a revolution classic lines, with the working class playing a leading role, although they are reduced in numbers. But this situation is characterized by the absence of an independent leadership of the working class and the heavy role played by Stalinism. And this is a very important part of the development of our of Marxism in the post-war period, was the contribution of Ted Grant on this issue. The most important factors in the situation were the change, which was determined by the war in power relations between imperialist powers in the post-war period, the development of the colonial revolution as a wildfire throughout the world, while at the same time the proletarian revolution in the advanced capitalist countries was delayed for an entire period because of the defeats of the revolutionary wave after the Second World War and the stabilization of capitalism. And fourth is the emergence of a huge important pole of attraction, which is represented by the USSR and then strengthened by the transition towards proletarian Bonapartist regimes to form worker states in Eastern Europe through the invasion of the Red Army, and the development of the Chinese Revolution, 1949. And so the reformed worker states emerge as a very powerful point of reference and attraction for the colonial revolution. And Stalinism becomes plays in this respect an important role in development and in the deformation of the colonial revolution over a few decades. The state, the bourgeois state, in all these countries, in Egypt, in Yemen, in a number of countries which went through the same kind of process, was not as solid as it was not the same kind of machine that the bourgeoisie has developed through centuries in the advanced capitalist countries. Was a state which was heavily dependent on the colonial rule, and in a situation of collapse of the colonial rule, and of extreme weakness of the ruling classes in a situation where the objective conditions for revolutionary transformation of society are not just ripe, but even getting rotten in the colonial world, and of powerful movement towards independence and national democratic revolutions. In this situation, the permanent revolution, one of the features of the permanent revolution, which is the idea explained by Trotsky that the revolution which starts on democratic basis in the epoch of imperialism cannot be led, a democratic bourgeois revolution cannot be led by the bourgeoisie itself. And we described what the conditions of the ruling class in Egypt were. The Egyptian ruling class, even the national bourgeoisie, was not able or willing to lead the national revolution. Under these conditions, other classes must take the responsibility and will take the responsibility to carry out the tasks of the democratic revolution. This class is the working class, and this gives the revolution a permanent character, because the working class, once in power, once manages to overthrow the colonial rule, cannot and will not stop to the democratic bourgeois tasks, and the revolution will grow over into a socialist revolution. This is one of the bases of the permanent revolution. But in the specific conditions of the post-war, because of the factors that I explained before, and the weakness of the revolutionary leadership, and the role of Stalinism, which led to the paralysis of the working class, this process expresses itself in a distorted way. The army, in particular, but also sections of the ruling class, these societies filled in the vacuum left by the working class. And of course, this process means deformed revolution, which takes a Bonapartist character by definition. In a situation where the nature of this Bonapartist regime is not settled in advance, the class nature. Because through internal struggle within the army, coup after coup, different sections of the army reflecting different classes in society, or groups, or parts of classes, could emerge as winners and determine the final outcome of this. This process is not determined by the working class itself in each country, but rather by the international relations forces between the classes and with imperialist powers. So to go back to the free officers' coup, this coup represents the beginning of the national democratic revolution in a distorted way, which was directed against sections of the ruling class, at least. So in a classic Bonapartist fashion, we see the free officers attacking what was supposed to be the ruling class. And the first phase of the regime, what will become the Nasser regime, is an attempt to achieve national independence through maneuvering between different colonial imperialist powers, looking for the support of the United States, for example, who have an interest in undermining the colonial rule of Britain and France over the Arab world, of course. So we're not talking about any transition to proletarian Bonapartism in this phase of the deformed worker state. But the first measure, important measure taken by the Free Officers Movement, Free Officers Supreme Council, is the agrarian reform, which is, of course, a fundamental conquest for the Egyptian masses, the peasantry. That was in September 1952. Through the agrarian reform, 400,000 landowners are expropriated, and the land is granted access to the land with different forms to landless peasants. The burning need of the regime is to achieve national independence from imperialist powers. they tried to achieve it by maneuvering between the different imperialist powers and the USSR, of course. Because the way to achieve it is to have a better army in their minds, to start an industrialization process guided from above, and in order to achieve that, they try the way of different deals between the revolutionary government and different powers. Get investments, arms supplies, training, and so on. But this doesn't work. They don't manage to achieve that. At the same time, the regime has to grant quite important reforms to the masses to quiet them. We already mentioned the agrarian reform, but that's not the one. In the next years, there are a number of concessions also to the working class. National insurance, a law against sacking, labor laws, and so on, increasing wages. But the nature of this regime is not one of representing directly or other than in a very, very distorted way the pressure of the workers and the poor masses in Egypt. And the way this regime behaves is one of the classical Bonapartist, which is to repress strongly and grant concessions in order to stabilize the situation. One episode, of course, this is related to a very small part of the vanguard of the working class, which is quite revealing. And this happens just a couple of months after the coup. A big strike of the workers at Kaf El Dawar, one of the big concentration of the working class, is broken up by the army sent by the three officers. The leaders of the strike are arrested, and two of them are executed. Mustafa Kamis, who was an important trade union leader, and another worker picked up among the strikers to teach them a lesson, Muhammad al-Bakri. This was a factory where the Communist Party had an influence, but provoked a big reaction amongst the working class in the area around Alexandria and even Cairo. Strikes spread to other factories, and again, the Communist Party, or what was left of it, in a situation where they had some roots in that particular section of the working class, not only failed to give a lead to the reaction of the workers, but even went around in the Kafr El Dawar area to defend the idea that there shouldn't be a strike. So this, of course, provoked splits and collapse of the Communist Party in those cases, small cases, where they had actions. So the regime consolidates with Bonapartist fashion through concessions and repression at the same time. By January 1953, so just 6 months later, all the parties are banned. The WAFT, the Communist Party, WAFT. The newspapers of the Communist Party are closed down. Wave of arrests and so on. But still, it's a relatively weak regime which needs to consolidate. But the real turning point in the situation, until now the regime has granted reforms on, has not managed to consolidate. The turning point is between 1954 and 1956. At the end of 1954, there is an assassination attempt against Nasser by the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood, being enabled themselves to aim to get to conquer power at that stage, they supported the free officers in the beginning, and then tried, because of course they also had some support within the army, and they had some cards to play. They tried to conquer power positions within the new regime in the first place, and in failing doing so, they or some of them or a part of them decided to try to attempt the life of Nasser and open up again the situation. After the assassination attempt, there was a clampdown on the Muslim Brotherhood by the army. Hundreds of the leaders were arrested. Some of them were executed. And then there is the real big turning point in the situation, because the regime led by Nasser at this point is in a blind alley. They need to go further with their reform and the process of industrialization of Egypt, but they cannot do it without breaking decisively with the imperialist powers. And here we see how, in spite of the deformations, the permanent revolution theory applies to this development. Paradoxically, the need to find its own way towards capitalist development for a country like Egypt and to achieve national independence, which means having industrial production capacity, not just producing agricultural products for export, energy, control over the natural resources, and so on. Any project in that direction collides with the interests of imperialism. So in 1955 and 56, there is a big turning point in the situation, determined by the attempt by Nasser to achieve the means to finance and bring forward an important infrastructural project, which is the Aswan Dam. The Aswan Dam was a project financed by US, French, British capital. But because of the development of the position of the regime, the free officers regime in international relations, in international politics, the imperialists think they can use their control over the financial the fuel to actually build this dam, the capitals, and so on. They threaten once Egypt recognizes China, the Chinese state, in an international dispute. Egypt recognizes the Chinese state as a legitimate state. As a retaliation to this measure, the imperialist power announced that they are withdrawing or holding on their capitals for the Aswan Dam. In order to achieve the resources independently, Nasser decides to nationalize the Suez Canal. And of course, this is something that the imperialist powers didn't like very much. The Suez Canal was regarded by Churchill, by all the strategists of Britain in this case, historically, throughout the decades, as the most important asset, the most important strategic asset in the Middle East. And so the nationalization of the Suez Canal also represents a huge boost to the national sentiment of and the pan-Arab nationalist sentiment throughout the Arab world. In all of a sudden, there is a huge wave of support for Nasser and the free officers regime. The reaction of the imperialist powers to this measure of the nationalization of the Suez Canal was, say, with hindsight, probably not the best. They thought that by attacking and seizing the Suez Canal with a blitz over Egypt, they could sort out the situation and put down, you know, the annoying development. But in that case, they clearly miscalculated. The Suez War was a disaster for British imperialism, British and French imperialism, and further radicalized and pushed not just Nasser, but the whole Middle East on a colliding course with imperialism. The miscalculation was mainly, well, the plan was that Israel would wait an attack, and British and French would answer in support of Israel in the moment when Egypt fought back. The strike was the first part of the wars was military term success from the point of imperialism. They managed to seize control of the Suez Canal, but they miscalculated the mass reaction. Just to give an idea, in the city, Egyptian cities around the Suez Canal, hundreds and thousands of people took the street and demanded the government to provide them arms. It wasn't just the Egyptian army. Actually, it was not mainly the Egyptian army to resist this attack, but it was people armed with sticks and stones. A huge wave of movement to resist to this aggression developed throughout the Middle East. In order to stop this, and also because of the weakness of the imperialists, the position of the French and British imperialism, and the divisions between the imperialist powers. The threat by the Soviet Union to provide arms and support to the Egyptian army at that stage, which was completely instrumental, by the way, but this had allowed the US imperialists to intervene and stop the adventure. So the outcome of the Suez War was not cannot be really described as a victory for the Egyptian army or anything like that. But objectively speaking, the fact that imperialist powers had attacked and they had to withdraw was seen by the masses throughout the Arab world as the victory they were waiting for. The first real defeat for Israel, and a boost for the idea that was growing, that Nasser was starting to put forward, which was the idea of unifying the Arab nation against imperialism, and so on. The period after the Suez War is a period of radicalization and internal struggle in the regime, where one after another step of the government ended up in weakening or undermining the power and the rule of what was left of the Egyptian bourgeoisie. So in the case of Egypt, what we see is a Bonapartist regime, which nominally starts as a bourgeois Bonapartist regime, and then under the pressure of the development of the revolution and the dynamic of the revolution, reaches the point of being very near, close to breaking every link, to sever all links with the ruling class, the nominal ruling class. And after 1956, there is a nationalization of all foreign property, which means a lot of banks, for example. Banks, the property of the British or French. And in the early 60s, this process reaches a point where it can be described as breaking the economic power of the big capitalists, when the nationalization process reaches a point of nationalizing all the major companies. So we see that the Nasser regime reaches a point where the class nature of states are at least blurred, and heading towards a break with capitalism and the establishment of the deformed worker state, a proletarian Bonapartist regime. But here we see the weakness also of this process, which is basically depending on the international relations of forces. And the Bonapartist nature of the regime has undermined and paralyzed any independent action of the working class, which is the only class that can actually achieve a working state. So what we have is an extreme caricature of a transition towards a proletarian Bonapartist or the form worker state, which was eventually aborted. And because of the change in the international relations after the death of Nasser, because of the lack of any control over the process by the working class itself, the same regime could be reversed, and the direction of the process could be reversed by a succession of adjustment, change policies, and so on. And end up in that monstrous dictatorship I've seen overthrown, or at least the beginning of the beginning of the end of this regime. But that was definitely taking the road back towards capitalism. The Mubarak regime is the same machine that was in place and built by the free officers, but used to protect different interests and allow the formation and the enrichment of a powerful and rich ruling class, a new bourgeoisie, dependent from the state, supported growing up from the state and the military. So, well, I would have to talk about many other things, but the 2 hours are finished. And I hope that in the discussion, comrades will fill in the gaps of what I've left, raise questions, and discuss more. And in the reply, I will come back with some more questions that I left out.